Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Henry Strozier, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled A History of Ancient Sparta, Valor, Virtue, and Devotion in the Greek Golden Age. Your professor is Timothy Schutt. For more than 20 years, Professor Schutt has taught at Kenyon College, famed for splendid teaching, literary tradition, and unwavering commitment to the liberal arts. No teacher at Kenyon has ever been more honored, both by the college and by students, for exceptional skills in the classroom and as a lecturer. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin A History of Ancient Sparta, Kingdoms, Empire, and War. Lecture 1, Aura and Overview, Come and Take Them. And now, Professor Schutt.
In 1925, a Spartan worker hired to work on the British school dig beneath the Spartan Acropolis uncovered a statue of a very trim and strong-looking middle-aged warrior. The statue was fashioned in the 480s and to some degree belies our notion that Sparta was a realm which was, by its own wish, more or less artistically deprived. It's a very fine piece of work, and right at the outset, the worker who uncovered it assumed that it was Leonidas. The scholarly consensus is that it probably is not, in fact, Leonidas. It's just a little bit too late for that, and it purportedly represents, or the best guess is, that it represents a god or hero. I'm not so sure. In any case, it is one of my very, very favorite pieces of art from anywhere at any time, in part because it exemplifies, to me at least, and judging from its popularity to many others, what Sparta at its best was about. I like to think of it as Leonidas, in perfect physical condition, bare-chested, wearing a crested helmet with cheek pieces on which appear the head of a ram, one for each side. What's most distinctive about it is its calmness and its clear-eyed, confident smile. We don't perhaps ordinarily think of the Spartans as a smiling culture, but nevertheless, this half-smile, serene, quiet, seems to exemplify something that the whole lifestyle of Sparta was designed to achieve, and a state of mind that in this statue finds splendid and tremendously evocative expression. Perhaps foolishly, some of my friends have teased me about this. I have at times on the theory that adopting an expression can lead you to the state of mind, tried to reproduce that smile. And you know, amazingly enough, it does produce, at least in me, a calm, clear-sighted, to the extent that I'm capable of being clear-sighted, confident detachment. Very, very nice. Well, who was this? Who was this Leonidas? He was the Agaid king of Sparta, who, outnumbered 50-1, if not hundreds to one, or indeed, depending on who you choose to believe, thousands to one, at the narrow pass at Thermopylae in north-central Greece, assumed the command of the picked, largely Spartan holding force, which had been detached by the Hellenic Alliance to defend the approaches to Attica and the Peloponnese. In a desperate effort to keep the Persian Empire at bay, Xerxes, the Persian great king, when he recognized the apparent weakness of the forces arrayed against him at Thermopylae, and how very, very few they were in comparison to his own thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even according to Herodotus, millions, sent a message to Leonidas asking that he and his troops lay down their arms. Leonidas's reply is probably the most famous instance of laconic, Laconian taciturnity on record. The Spartans cultivated cogent, tight, spare speech, and he replied to the request in two words in Doric Greek. Molon labe. You want the arms? Molon labe. Come and take them. Which Xerxes did, but the process took 3 days, and by modern estimates, 20,000 or more Persian and allied casualties, as the 300 picked Spartans and their Thespian and at least some Theban companions who remained to the bitter end fought with consummate skill, finally tooth and nail, and to the death. Xerxes succeeded in forcing the pass, but the self-sacrificing and deliberately self-sacrificing, not to say suicidal devotion, of the Spartans and their allies really gave him pause. These Spartans, and the other Hellenes with them, were clearly, in some sense, not like the other folks whom Persia had overcome in the course of building the greatest world empire to date over the course of the last two generations. Overcoming these people, outnumbered as they were, clearly and shockingly, was not going to be easy, whatever the odds. And overcoming them, clearly, whatever the odds, was going to be no easy matter. The Greeks, by contrast, who had effectively never before defeated the Persians on the occasions in the past when Hellenes or Greeks of one sort or another had happened to encounter them, were, despite the seeming loss, encouraged. They could hold their own after all, and maybe, just maybe, succeed in holding off Persia. Indeed, a month or so later, at Salamis, under the inspired leadership of the Athenian Themistocles and others, but primarily Themistocles, they defeated the Persian fleet, and the next year, under the leadership of the Spartan regent Pausanias, doing service for the dead Leonidas' son, who was technically king, defeated the Persian holding force which remained at the Battle of Plataea, and the Spartan king Leotychidas, Sparta had two kings, which we'll talk about in a bit, won another battle at Mycale in Asia Minor, and they defeated the invasion once and for all. But at least arguably, and indeed by general consensus. The decisive moment was neither Salamis nor Plataea, but was the self-sacrifice of the Spartan 300 and others, led by the Spartans, at Thermopylae, which revealed to the Greeks that they could, beyond expectation, hold their own and just possibly win. Despite the major contributions of the Corinthians, of the Athenians, and others, and Herodotus thought that the Athenian victory at Salamis was really the decisive conflict of the war, and lots of people would agree with him. Even so, when those Greeks who decided to resist Persia banded together, they chose the Spartans as their leaders, in large part because Sparta led the so-called Peloponnesian League of allied poleis or city-states, but also because from the mid-500s at least, in other words, for three generations or four before that, Sparta had been, without serious dispute, the dominant polis, the dominant city-state of the Hellenic world. And the Spartans were all but universally admired for their surpassing arete, or virtue, and for their, as they called it, eunomia, which means good laws or good customs, good government, relatively peaceful, stable government. And they were, beyond that, by universal consensus and by a wide, wide margin, the most accomplished warriors in Greece, and as close to doubtlessly as such a statement can be, the finest warriors in the world. There's a contemporary video game that one of my daughter's friends used to play all the time, which focused on warfare in the ancient world, and you could get warriors of various kinds from various places. And I was touched by the status that they attributed to the Spartans. There were elite warriors, but the Spartans were beyond elite. And that is just about the size of it in truth. Despite that, though, Sparta comes down to us with a distinctly mixed legacy. On the one hand, we have the reputation of the Spartan warriors for courage, for unflinching devotion to duty, for self-sacrifice if necessary. On the other hand, as we will see, it was a state which was based on institutionalized oppression of a very, very large underclass. It was also a state which, though this can be overemphasized, more or less deliberately turned its back on much of what we think of as high culture. Certainly Athens far exceeded Sparta in terms of its contribution to architecture, ultimately to philosophy, to literature, to visual art in all of its guises. Sparta was, in a sense, a military camp grown into state size. And that has led to, in recent times particularly, a pretty consistently bad press. So much so that for years, having heard about the Spartans and particularly the ferocious Spartan upbringing for boys, since I was myself a boy and was appalled at the prospect that someone my age had at some time somewhere been subjected to what to me seemed almost unendurable severity. Despite all that, it was a surprise to me to discover how glowing the reputation of the Spartans was in antiquity and indeed in many quarters since then. And I couldn't understand how such a grim, tightly focused place, a place with so little sway for individual preference, could possibly have been appealing. Then, in 1998, right after it came out, I read Stephen Pressfield's novel, Gates of Fire, which is an inspired attempt to reimagine what it was like to be Spartan from within. And then, for the first time, I had at least the illusion that I understood. From that perspective, the keynote of life for the Spartans, for the homoioi or Spartes, the full citizen Spartan male elite, was a devotion to courage, to self-control, and to discipline. It's no accident that today the United States Marine Corps refers in advertisements on television to the possibility of joining the Marines as a possibility of making oneself into something as close as the modern world offers to a Spartan. Beyond that, the Spartans were known for an unflinching commitment to duty. To duty, if need be, unto death. Paradoxically, and this is a little bit surprising, and we'll have occasion as we proceed to talk about this in more detail, because it is not what we think of as freedom, but their devotion to the Spartan state was very much in service of what they conceived of as their freedom, as a self-governing polis, and indeed the resistance of the whole Hellenic alliance against Persia was mounted in large part in the basis of their commitment to their freedom as citizens. This is complicated for us because, though it varied from polis to polis, women were not citizens. They were more, they had a richer and fuller life in Sparta than anywhere else in Greece by a considerable margin. But even there, though they could hold property, they weren't citizens. And it's also compromised by the universal Greek custom of slavery. But nevertheless, from a Greek perspective, everybody in the Persian Empire was a slave. And the citizen warriors of Sparta and indeed of the other Greek states thought of themselves, by contrast, as free men. The Spartans were also known above all for their military skill and their military cohesion. And this was something that they purchased by a one-dimensional devotion to that, which no other polis came close to matching. For one thing, they exercised relentlessly. Spartans were in shape. Male and female, public exercise every day and lots of it. They were, in effect, full-time trained athletes and had been so from the time they were 7 years old when they entered the Spartan upbringing, which emphasized, as you might imagine, physical fitness very, very highly indeed. They were, in effect, professional soldiers, a professional army, the only one in existence at that time. That being the case, they didn't go into battle as other citizen armies did. The preferred Greek mode of warfare at the time was battle between lines of hoplites, ordinarily several hundred long and eight deep, standing shoulder to shoulder, armed with a heavy shield, a spear which they held in their right hand over their shoulder, with a helmet, sometimes with greaves. They would crash together in a battle line which they called the Othismos, and sooner or later one line would break. There were ordinarily not many casualties until that break came. Then, when people dropped their shields and began to run away, casualties on the losing side began to grow quickly and disproportionately, and were sometimes very, very high. Ordinarily, confronting such a threat, citizen armies had to overcome their fears and do whatever they felt was necessary to force themselves to endure the extremely difficult task of staying in line under such conditions. The Spartans, by contrast, and very, very deliberately, marched slowly into battle, in step, to the music of flutes, demonstrating that even in the moment of impending conflict, their self-control was razor-edge tight. Often, that spectacle in and of itself was enough to persuade the opposing battle line to break and flee. And if that happened uniquely, the Spartans did not pursue. They just let the other army go, refraining from inflicting the casualties that they easily could have on the grounds that the point was not, as a general rule, to destroy whoever they were fighting against. The point was merely to demonstrate their superiority and the unwisdom of disputing Spartan tactics. All of these things lead Pressfield to say in his novel, and there is oddly enough real evidence that this is true, that in a battle between two poles, one Spartan, even one on one side, could make a decisive difference. And indeed, in the winter of 415-414, the Spartans decided to send a general, Gylippus, to help the Syracusans in their fight against a huge Athenian expeditionary force. He did have a very few troops with him, but effectively, it was that single general who turned things around and made the difference. Later on, in the First Punic War, the Carthaginians were having a terrible time fighting the Romans. And they hired for 1 year a Spartan mercenary commander who took charge of the Carthaginians and succeeded once again in totally turning things around. All of which is to say, I suppose then as now, there is really no substitute for expertise and training, and the Spartans had expertise and training. Also, interestingly enough, and this is surprising, as I mentioned before, the position of women in Sparta. This is one of the things that appeals to people. The position of women in Sparta, we'll talk about this in more detail later, was higher than any place else in the ancient world, except conceivably among the ancient Germans, barbarians from the perspective of the Greco-Roman world, and in some senses just conceivably among high Roman aristocrats around the time the Republic died and the Empire came into being. Even then, I would say that women had it better in Sparta than anywhere else. But there are aspects of Sparta, even so, which virtually anyone would find troubling. It was, culturally, by choice, a state devoted to self-chosen and self-inflicted frugality. It reminds me a bit of some contemporary Greens who deliberately consume less for moral reasons than their financial position would enable them to. The Spartans felt the same way. They cultivated nudity. They cultivated plain dress. They cultivated plain living, plain cooking, plain houses, all of the above. Which is not to say that some of them weren't wealthy or very wealthy, but the ethos of Sparta in Sparta's heyday was very much against anything remotely resembling conspicuous consumption. Beyond that, they were devoted to war, and certainly war above all, if not war and only war. And the reason for that is the most unsettling thing about Sparta. Sparta controlled a larger area by a lot than any other Greek polis, and they were outnumbered at least 10-1 by the Helots, the enslaved local population over whom they ruled with an iron, not to say a murderous hand. And the original reason, so most contemporary theorists would argue, and I would be inclined to be persuaded, for Sparta as a military camp was the need at all times to be able to put down brutally, quickly, and thoroughly a rebellion of the Helots. They so thoroughly oppressed their underclass that they had to live life as an armed camp in order to keep themselves in a position of dominance. And that is, by any standard that I know of, the worst thing about Sparta and the overarching flaw that prevents them, despite their many virtues, from being anything like unambiguously admirable. In a lighter context, perhaps we would feel differently about institutionalized pederasty than they did. It was customary for Spartan boys undergoing the agoge or training at about the age of 12 to take on, this was expected, an older lover, generally about 20 years old, who was supposed to be the young boy's inspirer, and more or less institutionalized homoerotic relations up until about age 30 were part of the program. This is not to say that pederasty did not find adherence, and homosexuality, though not homosexuality generally of the sort that we are inclined to think of today between two consenting adults whose sexual preferences lead them that way, but rather typically between an adult and a young adolescent. As the adolescent grew through those growing years, it was more institutionalized at Sparta than elsewhere, but in Thebes, in Athens, and in lots of other places, that was part of the Hellenic cultural package. All of this, the enduring Spartan reputation, both for good and for ill, led a French scholar named Ollier in 1933 to 43 to come up with a work entitled Le Mirage Spartiate, the Spartan Mirage. Sparta was, among other things, increasingly as time went on, very interested in self-publicization. They thought they had the moral answer and were encouraged when other people agreed with them, and they generated a whole sea of admirers, not only in antiquity, Critias and Plato, to name two, who are Plato in particular, very well known, but since then too. And what's odd about it is that Sparta has proved, for rather different reasons, very appealing to thinkers on the left and to thinkers on the right. Rousseau, for instance, loved Sparta because of the Spartan citizens' commitment to the state above all. He thought of it as a precursor to his own doctrine of the general will. And throughout the Cold War, it was customary to read Thucydides' account of the Peloponnesian War, the battle for supremacy in Greece between Sparta and allies and Athens and allies, in terms of the conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States taking on the role of Athens, free, democratic, culturally rich, and so forth, and the Soviet Union with grim Stalinist architecture and state-enforced uniformity of belief and so forth, taking on the role of the Spartan state solidarity above all. And indeed, it's no accident that throughout the Marxian world, up through the end of the Cold War, there were regular celebrations which were explicitly termed Spartacist. The idea being that Sparta did, in fact, provide a valuable and viable model for the sort of commitment to the states and to solidarity that communism at its best exemplified. But, as you might imagine, some of those virtues at least appeal to people on the right as well. The Germans were very intrigued with Sparta and with Dorian values, Spartan values essentially, as opposed to Ionic values. Hitler admired Sparta greatly, and as the appeal of the Spartans to the Marines suggests, anybody who is interested in courage, discipline, and duty as a high set of values, and those folks are more often found on the right than not, has historically found in Sparta plenty of grounds for admiration. Perhaps a bit more surprising is the admiration of Michel de Montaigne, as expressed in his essay on the cannibals in 1580. He says, "There are triumphant defeats that rival victories. Salamis, Plataea, Mycale, Sicily are the fairest sister victories under the sun. Three of them in the Persian Wars, one against the simultaneous war between Sicily and Carthage. Yet, they would never compare their combined glory with the glorious defeat of King Leonidas and his men in the pass of Thermopylae." And indeed, later on, there were prominent cultural figures in France who saw fit to compare Leonidas and his self-sacrifice for the good of Greece as a whole to Jesus himself, to the crucifixion. Peculiar. One final legacy, and this, for good or for ill, I can speak of at some removes firsthand. When the British, during the Victorian era, led in this sense by Thomas Arnold at Rugby, crystallized the institution of the British public school or prep school or boarding school, they, and to some degree their American counterparts, looked to the Spartan agoge, stern, unrelenting, strict, and so forth, as the ideal mode for training future leaders. And to some degree, I can testify, to some vestigial degree, I can testify, there are schools in this country and in England as well where that ideal still, to some extent, lives even now.
This ends Lecture 1.